So myoglobin, when it binds oxygen, the shape of that molecule makes it appear, the surface of the product appear red. But unfortunately, you could say that is not a permanent status, right? Because it will leave, the oxygen will dissipate. And you have processes that are still in the early parts of shelf life, still going on to cycle and reattach oxygen kind of over and over again. Ultimately, those processes do run out of literally energy postmortem in the retail case, and you get the appearance of brownness, which is because it's what we call metmyoglobin.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lallemand Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandi Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and very brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, we are joined by Dr. Jared Legaico, Associate Professor of Meat Science at Texas Tech University. Dr. Legaico earned his master's at Oklahoma State University in Food Science and his PhD in Animal Science from Texas Tech. Dr. Legaico's research program primarily focuses upon pre- and post-harvest factors which influence beef quality. His program is differentiated from others based on his usage of analytical chemistry to explore beef flavor character and beef flavor development. Some of the specific factors being explored in his research group include how animal diet, management, genetics, post-mortem aging, packaging, and cooking all influence beef flavor. So as you can tell, we are really breaking down beef quality down to the brass tacks today. So let's get started with that. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Legaico.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on the show and appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak with us. You and I had a chance to catch up a bit before the show started, but for those of who were not privileged to that conversation, if you could just bring us up a little bit on your background, like how you got started in this area of study, you know, that kind of thing, and how you got to the career that you're in now and your background in the beef and cattle industry, that would be great.
Yes, meat science is a unique career choice. I mean, I think it's certainly not something your typical high school student knows about or is even have much awareness unless they have someone in their family associated with it. And oddly enough, I did. I had an uncle who also went to Oklahoma State and studied animal science and was a meat judger. And so that really didn't influence me greatly. I went on a number of avenues before pursuing food science in my master's, and it wasn't quite focused yet on meat science. I did more with oil seeds and looking at quality of oils. But I discovered meat science faculty at Oklahoma State during that time period and interacted a lot with graduate students who were studying meat science and really became excited about the topic area, took some courses, and then transitioned to that in my PhD at Texas Tech. At Texas Tech, I studied under Dr. Chance Brooks and worked with a lot of the faculty here. And it was a really exciting time. I benefited from a lot of unique opportunities. One was kind of throughout that whole time period, Texas Tech was one of a few universities doing the nutrient database improvement study. And so that was literally working through all the major cuts of the beef carcass from the chuck to the round through four phases and looking at the nutritional composition of raw and cooked meats to update the nutrient database. And so that went on my entirety here. It gave me a intimate awareness of, you know, the beef carcass, beef fabrication. It was a great education in working through the beef carcass. And then also in laboratory work with meat, doing a number of chemical composition measurements, working with meat to really assess all those attributes that contribute to nutrition and the nutrition facts panel. So that was a really unique opportunity. And then the other thing is I had some background before graduate school, working in a lab, doing some chemical measurement of soil and water and sludge samples, which, again, not very close to meat science. But that background, working with instrumentation, allowed me for my dissertation work to take that and look at flavor. So flavor is among our key attributes, tenderness, juiciness, and flavor is what we typically talk about for palatability, eating quality. And flavor is really dynamic because we perceive that through chemical sensations on the tongue and then through the nose. And so it took some chemical measurement in order to start working with flavor and trying to assess flavor. And through that, kind of in graduate school, I was able to carry over and have done a lot of that work since, leaving graduate school.
Well, you spoke, you said meat science is not like, well-known. There's an area of study I'm not quoting you verbatim there, but I think it's a really probably underappreciated area of study because it's not just you go cut up some meat. Like there's art and science to it. Specifically, my husband went to, he took like an advanced meat fabrication course or something like that when we were in grad school. And I remember he would have to go in and like break down a whole carcass and things like that. And it was very stressful to make sure you get the right cuts and things like that. And I did not take that class, but I can appreciate how difficult it was. So it's definitely an underappreciated art for sure.
Yeah, it's broad in a sense because it entails anatomy, like you just said, but also physiology and biochemistry. And then also microbiology. And then you go towards the consumer side and you're thinking about maybe some more social topics as well as it relates to consuming meat, selecting meat, purchasing decisions, those type of topic areas. So a lot of opportunities for, interesting, research, a lot of areas that you can explore within meat science.
Yeah, for sure. You bring up that's a great segue into kind of our first topic, and you brought up consumers. And so how are consumer preferences and market demands, how do those influence the industry, your approach to beef quality?
Yeah, I think it's pretty well established that beef in particular is quality is paramount, right? You look at the costs of production. The costs of animals, costs of finishing and processing are very high. And so quality is what is really differentiates it from other protein sources, right? If you think about it. And you see that it carries a higher price point and what consumers are generally willing to pay it because of quality. They think about taste. If you look at the beef demand monitor that Dr. Tonzer puts out at K-State, consumers are, almost every time I would say, every time I've looked at it, I would will consistently rank taste, wholesomeness, some of these things as their main motivators for and what they characterize as important to them in meat. And there's a lot of other things, a lot of other topics that are important, like sustainability.
Right. And,
environment. But when really you're at the retail case, you're trying to figure out what you want to eat and you want it to taste good. You want it to be of high quality. You want it to be nutritious. And that's really how beef becomes so strong in demand is by maintaining quality and that consumer perception of exciting and exceptional eating experience.
Have you noticed because I know demand is like an upward trend for past several years. Have you noticed consumer preferences changing like maybe in the last 5 years or 10 years or anything like that? Or is it high quality has been the preference and that demand for those things hasn't changed?
I think it's a really good question, and I don't have any specific data to speak to, but just from, you know, kind of observing the retail case, and I think this may be somewhat a product of COVID, but we have a lot more interest in cooking at home. We have
more
households that are, you know, it's tough with inflation too. They're looking to see where they can cut some costs, and preparing, cooking in the home is one way to do that. And meat is central to that. I mean, on the great proportion of this country and worldwide, we are a meat consuming species. And you think about preparing a meal, that's generally where you start. You know, what are we going to do? And we start with that and then go from there. So I think maybe those couple things, the inflation, and then also maybe some COVID development of people's skills has carried over and perhaps impacted demand.
Yeah, I think that's right on the nose. I mean, people weren't allowed to, or not necessarily allowed to, but like were discouraged from going to restaurants, or restaurants were closed. And so, and a lot of people I don't live where you can just DoorDash things. So yeah, I think that you're right that home cooking definitely increased, and people have more of an interest in cooking, whether it be beef, or a lot of people got into baking and sourdough. So that's definitely a pattern I don't see is going to stop, for sure. So has that pattern or that observation influenced any research that you've done in the past, I guess it's 2025, so past 5 years?
And we've done a lot of things over the years, and we started out maybe being a little closer to the producer, looking at things like animal diet, looking at, you know, finishing days on feed and those type of aspects, all really important. But really in the past 5 years, we've been focused on things like packaging, aging. And then another kind of product of COVID was looking at creating flexibility in the supply chain through freezing of product, whether it be subprimals or individually packaged, you know, steaks. So those are more of the things we've been looking at in recent years. And you're right, they are closer to consumers. And I think perhaps that's been a thought in the back of my mind, is since we are wanting to maximize the available product at retail, you know, what can we do along the supply chain, you know, from processing through distribution and then at retail, to maintain quality and also try to, you know, present that in a way that is going to create some comfort in the minds of consumers to take it home and try to cook meals with it.
You know, you're speaking about multiple things, but kind of talking about retail there, you're talking about packaging and such like that. If you look at it, you know, you swing the pendulum to like my side of the supply chain, the production side, we're cow-calf and do some stockers. What role does me as a beef producer, the beef supply chain play in like maintaining or improving quality even more? And like, maybe, well, I have a follow-up question after that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have the, what many would point to on the producer side, you know, genetic selection, you know, just the way that you are producing those animals and marketing those animals with quality in mind it's probably the number one answer. But if you think about, you know, going forward, you know, if you have opportunities to, you know, educate or visit with consumers about things like cookery or packaging and help them grow in confidence, one of the things that we could really do to improve things is to have greater adoption of vacuum packaging. I mean, that's the best way to maintain quality.
Okay.
But we, as you know, we have kind of a predisposition for color, mm-hmm. and vacuum packaging largely reduces some of the redness, mm-hmm. shifts more towards a purple color. And, you know, consumers are more acquainted with that bright cherry red color. It looks really nice, obviously, but it does have a significantly shorter shelf life. And what we could do is you know, start to work with them. And we do see growth in this area, but I think it's still an area of opportunity to work with consumers to grow in comfort with vacuum packaged beef.
I'm glad you brought up the vacuum packaging, because I know that there's a lot to it. It's not just a piece, you know, you don't just throw meat in a tray, put some plastic on it, or vacuum package it, and it's done. Like, there's a lot of science behind this. I know this. I get a lot of questions from people or accusations from people about grocery store beef that, like, if it's not bright cherry red, it's like months old. And so I am now going to pick your brain about these different, we're going to go down a different path now briefly about the different packaging. So when beef is in the grocery store, you got ground beef and like, it's kind of light brown on the inside, on the outside. Right. But like, if you get that pound of beef and I'm not talking about a chub, I'm talking about like in the tray, and you break that open and it's brighter red. Can you explain that to me so that I can explain that to people who don't trust grocery store beef? Because it's always a touchy topic when I put it out there to discuss. And I know that beef is safe at the grocery store. I know that ground beef does not have food dye added to it or some random chemical. Like, I know that, but it's so hard for me to explain like the science in a basic way because I wasn't trained in that area. So I would love it if you would break that down for me and then for the masses listening to the podcast, and then I can take that and also use it. So
yeah, this is great. I mean, this is a meat scientist's favorite topic because it's so,
oh, okay.
It really is so visual, right? You have a pigment molecule that is inherent to muscle tissue called myoglobin. Mm-hmm. Myoglobin sounds a lot like hemoglobin, which a lot more people are familiar with because it's the molecule that circulates in your blood, transports oxygen, but in living tissue, it actually deposits that to myoglobin. That's kind of the function of it. But then after, you know, you've gone through all the steps to produce ground beef, it's still there and it will still bind oxygen. So myoglobin, when it binds oxygen, the shape of that molecule makes it appear that the surface of the product appear red. But unfortunately, you could say that is not a permanent status, right? Because it will leave. The oxygen will dissipate. And you have processes that are still in the early parts of shelf life still going on to cycle and reattach oxygen kind of over and over again. Ultimately, those processes do run out of literally energy postmortem, mm-hmm, in the retail case, and you get the appearance of brownness, which is because it's what we call metmyoglobin. And so that happens at the surface. It starts at the surface of products like you were talking about, kind of at that interface where oxygen is present, and then towards the inner parts where it is less dense. And so that's a kind of a critical spot. So what you can have is a lot of color variation in ground beef if you break that open. So my first thing I think you would want to say to consumers is, if it's there and you don't find any other objectionable characteristics like odor, it's perfectly fine to work with that and use it. I will say, though, if it is extensive, that generally happens at the end of shelf life, and you probably are going to have, going along with that, growth of spoilage organisms that start to give you some of the off odors and off flavors. Safety really doesn't come into any of this if you cook properly, right, to the appropriate internal degree of doneness. But it's a place where you have to make a judgment call. A little development of brownness is not a problem. You see this a lot of times under films where there's a label. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. The label sitting on top of the ground beef creates kind of an interesting environment where the oxygen density is a little lower and you get some of that brownness develop on the surface of the meat. So, for example, that's not a problem. You open it up, it may actually rebloom and develop redness. I think consumers have to think about this very complex, you know, process and topic, and recognize that it's not the end of the world to have some brownness, But if you have a lot, it could be that you're towards the end of shelf life.
That all makes perfect sense to me. The thing that doesn't confuse me, but interests me is you said if you expose it to oxygen, will it go from brown back to red?
It may for a period of time, right? And so
like a period of time of like 12 hours?
No, we generally see color stability. You know, ground beef is the most difficult because you've taken a bunch of different muscles, mixed them together, you've ground them, exposed them to some mechanical energy and grinding, and now they also have all these internal components that were inside tissues are now out and mixed, and you have oxygen exposure. So they ground beef has the most challenging shelf life, but you can generally see that ground beef maintaining, you know, color for 2 days, maybe 3 days.
If it gets bloom again.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm writing all this down. You can see our audience can't see this, but I'm taking notes.
Yeah. When we do a ground beef, you know, shelf life study, just depending on the prior, you know, treatments and everything, you know, makes a difference. But on the average, we're putting that in the case for 4 days. And by day, you know, somewhere in day 2, 3, you start to see some changes, more significant in 3, but then 4, we would have significant amount of discoloration because that energy that's required to color cycle and go back to red is pretty much depleted. And so you get the development of that permanent discoloration around 4 days for sure. And, you know, really, one thing I should mention, you know, in this topic of thinking about this with consumers is one thing they do have control of is if they purchase something, maybe it's discounted because it has a little bit of discoloration, is that they probably should prepare that within the day or the next day at the
moment. Gotcha.
You know,
yeah, because it's closer to the shelf life ending.
Yeah. Whereas if it's bright red, maybe it just got put on the shelf, you've got a little more time at home to store that before you have to prepare it.
Question, like the tray beef, because that's what I've been talking about here is the tray beef. You know, there's a pound of ground beef on the tray and it's got that. Is that plastic wrap, I'm using that term very generically because I don't exactly know what it is, but you're going to find out that I don't know. Does that, because I know there's a thing called modified atmospheric packaging. Is that what that is across it? Like, is that oxygen permeable?
It is oxygen permeable. So this is another topic that has a little nuance. So what you have are that film is polyvinyl chloride film is permeable to oxygen. And that is pretty much required so you can get that redness, that bloom that I've been talking about. You have to have some gas exchange. And so if you have a retailer that is maybe purchasing bulk ground beef and packaging in-house, right? Think about they're maybe getting in cases of 10-pound chub and they're working through that. They're making packages in-house and they would overwrap that and put it on the shelf. That doesn't go through any modified atmosphere. It's basically the atmosphere of the environment is what exchanges through the film, and that's what the meat is exposed to. We do have modified atmosphere, which is a technology that's been around for quite a while now, really since the 90s. And that modified atmosphere is where you remove the, you know, what we experience, the general atmosphere, and then you flush it with a prescribed gas mixture. And so you see this a lot where more characteristic in like these deep tray, rigid trays that have a more solid film on top. That's one way you commonly see modified atmosphere. That's gone out of, I guess, you know, use for many retailers, and they've transitioned to a different application that I'll talk about in a second. But the deep tray is something you would have seen, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, back when you and I were in college, right? That deep tray was a little more prominent, the use of modified atmosphere for maintenance of color.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The atmospheres that they use, there's really two kind of primary types. One is where this originated was thinking, okay, we want to develop redness. We want to develop color. So we're going to put a bunch of oxygen in there. So it's actually a high ox packaging. And so that does initially develop a lot of nice redness and color. The problem is that oxygen also degrades fat. It is an oxidizer of lipids. And so you actually see really poor shelf life with high ox packaging. And that's largely been moved away from in the U.S. And we're using a trigas mixture that is dependent on an active gas in carbon monoxide at a low percent. So it's at 0.4% in the atmosphere. And then the remaining bit is made up with CO2 or nitrogen gas. CO2 and nitrogen are both inert. They don't interact with anything. They maintain lipids. CO2 is actually somewhat antimicrobial, so that's positive. But the thing that everybody gets caught on is the carbon monoxide. So what do you generally think of when you hear carbon monoxide?
I mean, you think of people.
Yeah, you know, there's...
Not great things to people who overnight. Yeah.
Not great things, because remember I talked about hemoglobin, myoglobin, mm-hmm. oxygen? Well, we will also see carbon monoxide bind that. It's not good in a living person. But in postmortem tissue, you can put a very small percentage in the package that CO or carbon monoxide binds with myoglobin, and that promotes a more permanent red color. And so there's a lot of red flags that initially go up when you hear that, but there's been numerous studies that have determined that there is no dissipation of carbon monoxide from beef when it's taken out of the package and cooked. It's a very low percentage, and it binds so tightly to myoglobin that there's not great dissipation of that there's any kind of significant health concern for individuals from that use of that atmosphere.
I've learned so much.
Yeah.
The carbon monoxide is the 0.4%, right, that you mentioned?
Yeah.
Okay.
0.4% in that mixture. Yeah.
This is not where I thought our conversation was going to go, but I so appreciate you rolling with the punches, because this is important. And I think there's a lot of beef producers even that don't know the ins and outs of this. I mean, I took meat science in college, and I think I got an A in it, but I don't remember. I clearly don't remember any of this. Yeah. And I took it from an icon. So I'm sorry, Dr. Hunter, that I didn't remember any of this. But
central to a lot of this that I'm talking about.
Yes, I know. I failed I failed the meat science department at K-State. I'm very sorry, meat science aficionados. But that is all. That's just so relevant and also complex. So it makes sense that people don't want to, I find that people don't want to like dive into that detail much. And like you start talking about myoglobin and binding with oxygen, and then you kind of lose people. So there's got to be a way to like make it consumable, no pun intended.
Yeah, there are some good resources out there from NCBA and AMIS, you know, and then a lot of the extension, you know, universities will put out some good stuff around this topic area. But I will say this, you know, it is a little bit scary maybe sounding if, you know, your first time coming to it. And that's okay. If you don't want to buy this, you can still go to a full service counter and find someone that will package in, you know, your beef in the traditional, you know, butcher paper, if that's what you want. So I think that where these technologies come in is to improve shelf life, sustainability. The other thing I didn't mention earlier is consumers really value price. And so if we can create sustainability, longer shelf life, it does help with some of the price. Because you think about the turnover of product, if you're having to, you know, send some to waste, you know, that's a significant cost. So these technologies come in a lot to help address costs, but also, you know, maintain shelf life as the mechanism to, you know, address costs for consumers.
That's wonderful. I took two pages of notes there for our audience that can't see that. So, well, thank you for indulging me and breaking that all down, because it is important. And like I said, I don't think enough people take the time to investigate why that is. But it's a big thing with consumers for that. So I appreciate, again, you indulging me with that. So you mentioned this a little bit earlier about the my side of it, the beef production side. So the follow-up that I kind of had is where are critical points in that beef production chain where quality is compromised or can be compromised?
Sure. I think you go to, I don't know how familiar your listeners or you are with some of the beef quality audit work that's been done over the years. And so that's been monumental. It's done a lot of positive things in the supply chain, reducing bruising, adjusting where injection sites are, those type of bigger topic areas that producers have in control. And then at processing, it's a lot of maintenance of temperature, microbial load, time, and then getting product into more stable packaging so it can go out through distribution. Temperature is really critical. We've done some aging studies where you look at, really lower temperatures compared to more like moderate and then, still within the food safety realm, but higher refrigerated temperatures. And those do matter. We see changes in eating quality related to storage temperature. We see changes in shelf life. So there's a lot that are critical quality management pieces throughout that. And then you get to retail. It's how are you presenting that so that it moves off the shelf before you have, product deterioration. So it goes back to topics we talked about with packaging and et cetera.
Again, just really, those are important pieces to remember. From a production standpoint, is there any advice you can give people like me, cow-calf people, or stockers and feed yard people who are wanting to capitalize on premiums that are associated with high-quality beef, how to reach those premiums possibly from your viewpoint?
The recommendation I would have is to consider looking around, what's available to you locally and look for opportunities to maybe diversify a little bit, if that fits your scheme, to maybe work with a local processor for maybe some direct to consumer things that may catch some premium. I would say, though, largely you still want to maintain some of your conventional approach to production. But if you do have opportunities in your area to maybe capitalize on some of the interest in local production, and that's kind of a different type of premium that you can capture outside of the conventional quality grade premium, I think that's something to look at. Just depending on how you're situated, the quality grade conventional side is thinking about genetics, your environment, how much available forage and feedstuff you have, and those whole economics to try to drive towards improved genetics that predispose yourself to high quality cattle that are going to have good amount of marbling and we'll catch some premiums through that avenue.
So in other words, don't feed them like 4-year-old hay and right. don't ignore nutrition.
Well, the other thing to think about in management in general is stress. And we've done a few studies looking at stress and its impact. There's some large, Penn data showing that stress predisposes to impacts on tenderness and other things. And so as you think about continual improvement on your operation, areas where you can work to reduce animal stress, whether it be to illness, whether it be to handling or whatever, are some other possible things you would have in your control to work on.
Yeah, controlling stress is really, that's a big one, right? Like that's the whole BQA program right there. You have the beef. It's a different BQA. You know, you got the beef quality audit and you've got beef quality assurance. Those are different BQA things, but both very equally important. When I worked at the Red Angus Association of America, we released a paper about select quality beef just kind of like naturally phasing itself out. Like there's no rules or guidelines that are saying like we're not taking select quality beef. There's no retailers that are doing that. It's just like demand for high quality beef is causing producers to pay more attention to genetics and nutrition and stress management, things like that. And it's just naturally becoming less prevalent. So that's interesting how all of the things play a role in it. It's not just have better genetics. It's yes, you need better genetics, but you have to feed them. You have, you know, feed them the right things. You have to handle them correctly. It's a whole complex system of things to reach that.
It's time for our famous three.
Everyone knows vitamin D affects bone formation, immunity, and growth. What everyone doesn't know is research shows cattle don't get enough vitamin D. High D from DSM Firmenich optimizes health and growth with a more bioavailable form of vitamin D. And data shows high D fed heifers weighed over 8 pounds more at weaning. Don't let your cattle be vitamin deficient. Meet the growing needs of your herd year-round with high D. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/hy-d.
Well, I used so much of your time talking about beef color and beef packaging and things of that nature. And so we've gotten to the point of our episode now where we ask our closing questions. We ask the same questions of every guest. And I did give Dr. Legeko a heads up on these so that he's not just hit out of left field or anything like that. But what is the first one is, what is your favorite beef or cattle related resource? It can be a website or a book. One of my favorite answers was a guest who said that his wife was his favorite beef cattle related resource because she handled like the genetics and cattle management and things like that. So please share that with us.
Yeah, that's actually a difficult question, and so I'll probably cheat and give you a couple answers, but
that's fine. It's fine.
And I'm very biased towards this, but I read a lot of journals, and I play a part in the Meat and Muscle Biology Journal, and so that's one that I read quite a bit as we are working to put out research of our own or seeing research from other institutions. So that's one of my go-tos. But then more practically, the NAMP guideline for, the IMPS numbers for meat cuts, all those things play a critical role in our research because we want to do things in a way that's representative of the industry. And so we are working to fabricate, generate those type of wholesale and retail cuts in alignment with that guide.
You don't have all of those numbers for each cut number like memorized by heart now?
Largely, but you still go back and double check yourself a lot just to make sure, because there's plenty of numbers to kind of keep track of.
Well, I have not had that answer before, so that's great. Okay, and so maybe a little bit easier to answer is maybe what is your favorite non-beef or cattle-related book or just one that you're currently reading right now?
Oh, that's actually...
Is that tougher?
I didn't like this question because the reason why, and I don't know if anyone's ever said this to you, but I literally, for my job in academia, I read all day. And so largely when I go home, I'm going outside, I'm trying to do something else. So I don't do a lot of recreational reading. I think I've certainly had some given to me over the years that have been good, but it's been kind of minimal because my eyes are tired and I want to do something else when I get home. So
I understand you're not the only person to say that, actually. So
I'm going to skip out on that one a little bit.
That is okay. Like I said, you're not the only person to have said that to me. So don't feel like you're alone. Okay. And so the last one is, when you think of someone you admire or look up to, what's a characteristic they possess that has led them to be successful? It doesn't have to be, you don't have to tell us the person if you don't want to, but the characteristic.
No, characteristics of a, You know, and I see this in a lot of people. I've got some awesome collaborators, mentors, and, you know, they're really good at, I think the really good ones are good at communicating verbally in the written form. And then also just day to day, right? You know, if you need to call and communicate with something, you know, sometimes, you know, easy topics, sometimes difficult topics, and the really good ones are able to do both and, you know, do that very effectively. So communication. The other is work ethic, and then attention to detail is certainly a critical piece if you're, you know, anywhere in life, but in particular in science, where you're oftentimes, you know, you're criticized based on your level of precision. So you do have to have that finer attention to detail. And I'll say the last thing that sometimes I struggle with, that I admire in some folks, is focus, right? You have a mission in your, you know, teaching or research program, and you don't deviate a whole lot from that. My trouble is I get interested in a lot of stuff, but that is something I admire for those hard drivers that are really focused, is that they're creating something really, really good, and hopefully helpful for people. And they're staying on that mission.
I mean, for sure, the why is really important. You know, the why that drives your goal and your focus. You know, I can imagine that it can be difficult to stay focused on that when you're reading different scientific viewpoints and things every day. Scientific communication is like a bear in and of itself. It's very different than, you know, what I do, right? Communicating general topics, where you're trying to communicate complex topics, not only to other academia, but also to the general public so they can use that information. And that's very difficult for a lot of people. So I agree. Yeah. Well, that is all the questions and time that we have for today. I want to thank you again, Dr. Legeco, for joining us. I really appreciate your time and for indulging me of all my meat science questions I had. But if listeners have questions for you or want to learn more about our discussion today, where can they do that?
Probably the best way is through email. So I don't know if...
Well, I can put it in the footnotes, yeah.
Okay, if you want to put it in there. But my email, I'm not a large social media indulger. I do have a LinkedIn as well. I'll send that to you. But those are probably the main two things.
Okay. Well, I will put the email address of Dr. Legeco's email address, and then also you can find him on LinkedIn. Those will be in the footnotes of the episode for those who are listening and want to go back and look at this later on a desktop or find those links. You will be able to find those there. Again, Dr. Legeco, thank you so much for joining us and for being here and sharing your time with us. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in to the Beef Podcast, and we'll meet you back here next week.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.